Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to the 8th lecture of our series. Our last lecture for this year will be next Saturday night on December the 10th. And I should like to remind you again, for those of you who weren't here at the last meeting, that on that evening, Dr. Cowan will not be speaking. He is out at Washington, D.C. at a special conference. He will speak at a later date in March 18th, and on that evening his place is being taken by Dr. William Gibson, who was to speak on March 18th. Dr. Gibson is a member of our Department of Medicine at the university, and he will speak to us next Saturday night. He is, as you know, the professor of history of medicine and science, newly appointed, and has just returned from Yale University, and will give us a lecture that evening on the genesis of new ideas in science. Now, this evening, we're very pleased to have with us Dr. Davidson Dunton, the president of Carleton University. Dr. Dunton was born in Montreal in July 1912. He was educated in Quebec and attended the University of McGill and then later the universities of Grenoble, Munich, and Cambridge. He had decided at an early age to enter the field of journalism, and in 1934 he became a cub reporter for the Montreal Star. 3 years later he became the associate editor of that newspaper. And the following year, 1938, at the age of 26, became the editor of the Montreal Standard. Between 1938 and 1945, he carried on various positions in the field of both newspapers, and at the age of 33 was appointed to the chairman of the Board of Governors of the CBC. He held that position, as you all know, carried out his functions in a distinguished manner in the interest of Canada and our own cultural heritage here until 1958, when he was appointed president of Carleton University. He has a number of distinctions. He has been made a honorary doctor of laws of Laval University, Saskatchewan University, Queen's, and of our own University of British Columbia. Not the least of one of his distinctions, I think, is that his wife is a Vancouver girl, went to this university and was a graduate lawyer at the Department of External Affairs, where he met her and married her in Ottawa. It's a great pleasure this evening to introduce to you the Vancouver Institute, Dr. Davidson Dunton, who will speak to us on the subject, Who Should Go to University? Dr. Dunton.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, there's one thing, Mr. Chairman, which you left out of that very kindly brief biography. That is that, really, I'm an innocent from the East. I was flattered and honored at an invitation to speak at the Vancouver Institute of great renown and of considerable age, and on this subject. I thought it was one of those subjects on which you can produce, in most parts of this country, some generalities, a few special platitudes, perhaps a figure or two, an example or two, and get away with it nicely. I arrived in Vancouver, thing I always like to do, found I had made a great mistake. I'd fallen into a den of experts. Everybody I met was an authority on who should go to university. I realized they're not only authorities, they are very articulate authorities. I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that certainly in this city there are scores of people much better qualified than I am to speak on this subject. I'm sure in this room tonight there are quite a number who could do a more resounding Western kind of job anyway. And so, Mr. Chairman, what I ask is that you and the members of the Institute accept this as what it really is, an introduction to the real debate which will come later, in which I'll be glad to try to participate, if I can. And so I launch myself in this address with some trepidation, but also by assuming two major propositions. The first is that in modern times, knowledge has increased enormously, is growing now at an explosive rate, and is likely to grow at accelerating speed. The second is that knowledge and reasoned application of knowledge will increasingly determine the welfare of individuals, communities, national societies, and of mankind as a whole. Of course, as people say in all these speeches, the most striking developments, of course, have come in the fields of science and technology. The scientists have opened up hardly comprehensible possibilities of human self-destruction, but also of improvement in the physical welfare of human beings. And their very successes have at the same time insistently increased the need for new knowledge in other fields. The scientific advances themselves have given us a more complex society with many more immediate and strong interactions in it. Technological changes have led to much greater concentrations of populations, to larger and far more complicated organizations in industry, commerce, government, in institutions of all kinds, to vivid direct communication systems concentrated in large units, and to all kinds of new stresses on the lives of individuals and the lives of groups. In lots of ways, the world we're living in seems to be a sort of bundle of tight lines of tension and of interrelationship. The present state of the world and the probabilities of the future obviously call for a wide and for hard study, not just of scientific things, but of the problems of society and of the individuals in it. At the same time, I believe they call for continued devotion to other kinds of thought, the kinds which used to be unchallenged, the importance of which used to be unchallenged, to consideration of the general causes and principles of things, to ultimate realities, to the insights and beauties that lie in the literatures of the past and the literatures of other people, to the wisdom and the doings of men in other ages. Our forefathers built Canada in the last century largely by hard physical effort, backed by a good deal of determination, common sense, and not a little vision. Then, toward the end of the last century, in the first part of this, the very richness of our natural resources, combined with some of the new technical methods, led to a very rapid development. Later, like just about everybody else in the world, we suffered from the Depression of the 30s. But we came out of the war in a much better position than most other countries. Our productive capacity had actually grown a great deal during the war, and the whole organizational strength of business and government had increased, and we had suffered no destruction as so many other modern nations had. Looking back now, we can see, as we do, I think, pretty clearly, that Canada was in a particularly happy, privileged position during the post-war period of the late 40s and the 50s. I think it's very possible that these years will turn out, when people look back in history, to be of perhaps the coziest and the easiest times in the life of this nation. A number of other countries had, of course, suffered severely from the war, and the potential resources of a great many other areas were still undeveloped. When we look back now, it wasn't really terribly hard for us in the late 40s and 50s, with our resources and the position we're in after the war, to live pretty comfortably in comparison with most other countries, certainly out of this North American continent. Now, of course, the outlook is changing. Older nations across the Atlantic have remarshaled their knowledge and their skills. Resources in many parts of the world are being developed on a scale that makes ours now relatively much less important than they were in the period since the war. During the 60s and 70s, it seems now that Canada, in the very widest sense, faces far more intense competition than the 50s. And most of that competition, when you analyze it, based on knowledge expertly applied. In short, from the last century to now, our need has changed very dramatically from brawn to brains. Same time, of course, as always said in these speeches too, free civilization is now being challenged and will be as it never has been before. There's, of course, the military threat, the threat of complete obliteration, and there's the challenge, which may turn out to be much more significant, the challenge in the field of men's minds. I believe that most likely thought and the application of it are more likely to determine the future of the world and of ourselves than any shifting advantages in the balance of destructive power. In Canada these days, we fuss a good deal about our relationships with the United States and about the American influence on Canadian life. I'm not going to go into this, but I do suggest to you that, looking at the whole thing, that if we want to ensure, really, a rich and strong national life in the future, the most important thing of all is to provide the best possible opportunity for the minds of young Canadians to acquire knowledge, perception, and creative ability up to the level of their capacities. I think if we can do that, we can really count on a distinctive and worthwhile national identity in the future. In fact, just about everywhere we look, it seems to me that the facts of our times call for Canada to plunge and plunge heavily on brains and their development. I believe that our greatest single need for the years ahead is adequate provision for the development of our mind power to its varying potentials in all the various areas. There's, of course, a rising need for more highly trained professionals in various sectors of knowledge. It's obvious that we need scientists and engineers, not just some, but ones who can hold their own with the very best in the world. At the same time, it's equally plain, I think, that we need an increasing number of people prepared for really deep and intensive work in the social sciences. I think most of us in the room believe at the same time that we need not less, but more people prepared to spend their lives working in the fields of the humanities. And it is, of course, a main function of our universities to provide opportunities for learning for the future scholars and the future teachers, for the experts who in one way or another, not necessarily in universities, will spend their careers working in the higher reaches of knowledge. Universities, of course, also have to provide training for people to serve in the various professions they call learned or otherwise. But I myself do not believe that in our Canadian society, universities could or should restrict themselves to the education of an intellectual and professional elite. I believe that they must also provide higher education with more general objectives for others who are not going on to work essentially with specialized learning. The purpose of this kind of higher education, of course, is to enable young people to learn to think effectively, to organize their thoughts and communicate them effectively, to develop their abilities to make sound, reasoned judgments, to sharpen their senses of discrimination, help them to form values for themselves, and to develop their powers of imagination. Essentially, it's a kind of education that should develop their taste for learning, and above all, their ability to learn and their desire to keep on learning, and to learn effectively during the rest of their lives. I believe that this more general kind of university education, to use quite a vague description, with its lesser specialization, although it must have a good deal to be worthwhile as higher education at all, would be useful under modern conditions to almost anybody in any walk of life. The well-being of our society in the future will be to a large extent determined by the quality of the professional men of learning. I think, though, probably our kind of democratic society in North America will have its future determined just about as much by the intellectual qualities, and I use that word advisedly, of many other leading people in business and government in innumerable institutions, and also, I believe, in our homes. Increasingly, I notice in conversation that the brighter senior people in organizations of all kinds, government and business, call not just for trained experts, of which they need quite a few, but for young people with a general disciplined intelligence, the kind that you can get from higher education. It's not necessarily the special knowledge they have acquired at university that counts, but the mental powers, the general furnishings of their minds. Besides, I think it's worth remembering that some of the most excellent performers in later university work come from the ranks of those who started off just sort of wanting some higher education and not knowing quite why they wanted it. If we restricted university entrance at the beginning only to those who could be spotted for sure at that time as future scholars and high performers, we'd certainly miss a lot of very good people. I myself don't share the fears of some that if our institutions of higher learning develop too far in Canada, that we'd end up with a surplus of discontented bachelors of various kinds hanging about and wanting soft intellectual jobs. I think from all we can see now, the unemployed and the discontented are likely to be found among those with less education, not with more. Then again, we're a democracy after all, and main decisions still are really made by the people. And as the questions to be decided, the big ones become more and more complex, surely more and more important that the greatest possible number of people have the opportunity to develop capacities for making sound judgments on increasingly difficult issues. That, of course, means having as much education as possible. I've been talking for some minutes about what society needs from higher education. That's the other way to look at it, really the more fundamental way is in terms of the opportunities which a democratic society should provide to its individual members and under what conditions. We say we believe in the supreme importance of the individual. That surely means an education, but it means anything. We must believe in giving the individual a reasonable chance to gain knowledge and to develop his mind to the extent of his particular capacities and desires. I myself take this as a general, very broadly stated objective. But if we consider who is going to university in Canada at the present time, we're certainly falling very short of this ideal insofar as it relates to who goes to university. There can be argument about just how far short we're falling and in what respects, but I don't think there can be much disagreement about the fact that we are falling short. There's certainly plenty of evidence that many of our young people born with good minds are not having a reasonable opportunity at university education at all. I think we all know it from personal observations. There are the findings of studies such as the Atkinson study in Ontario indicating that somewhere over half the boys and girls with the degree of intelligence necessary for university work are not going to university. Also, the studies know, and our own observation proves, that the proportion of young people in country areas and small towns and from lower income families going to university is much smaller than those from among higher income families, particularly those living near universities. There's an obvious loss there. When the figures come out for this year, they'll show that the university enrollment in Canada is at present somewhat little above 10%, perhaps approaching 11% of the 18 to 21 year age group in the country. On the other hand, estimates on this continent of the proportion of young people with the native ability suitable for higher education, not the preparation, but the native ability of the caliber needed, run from around 25% or a little under, to around 40%. So we can see that even if one doesn't accept the 35 or 40%, that's too high, even accept 20 or 25 or 30, where quite a lot of the authorities agree, that there is a major loss of potential mind power. Various factors, of course, contribute to this loss. There are the financial barriers to higher education, which are still too high for quite a number of young people. And I think quite often we forget, certainly in the people in the East do, that those who live away from centers where there are universities are particularly handicapped. Going to university for them costs just about twice as much as for those who happen to live in the right cities where there are universities. Reduction in fees, of course, or further bursaries, especially scale for those who live far away, or a combination of both, would certainly provide a basis for some increase of the right people going to university. Must say, the new scholarship scheme in British Columbia seems to me very much a step in the right direction. Then there's another very important factor, perhaps now more important than the financial one, of young people, and often their families, simply don't appreciate the value of university education. I'm speaking of young people, of the right, with the right essential mental equipment. In many cases, probably the money could be found if people tried hard enough, but the ambition just isn't there. Actually, my own guess is that in this respect, we'll see quite a change in the coming years, and that there is an increasing realization among more and more people about the importance of university education for those who are suited for it. There's the factor, too, that of course, the total number of young people leaving high school is going to be growing very rapidly in the next few years, and probably increasing a good deal faster than the number of easy jobs waiting for 17 and 18 and 19-year-olds. I suspect that in the 60s, a clever young man deciding whether he will or will not go to university will be much less tempted than he has been in the last 10 years by the prospect of a pretty easy job with quite a good salary and the car and the fun that go along with it. Sometimes, too, I think people forget that, and in discussions of this kind about who can pay to go to university, that families are getting a good deal bigger than they used to be. I think it's right, I haven't looked up the figures, that a typical student of the 1950s who was born during the Depression would probably have about one brother or sister, or probably it's 0.9 or 1.3 or something of that sort. But I think a great many students of the post-war families of the 60s will have two or three or four brothers and sisters. And it's easy to calculate that the cost of university education, if the family happens to be a naturally bright one, for four members of a family, say, all having to live away from home to go to university, will come to well over $20,000. That's a pretty big sum of money for a family, even if the children work pretty hard all the summers, and even if some of them at least are bright enough to get some student aid of the various kind available. And there's the whole question of preparation for university apart from the native ability involved. In the last dozen years, of course, the overwhelming problem for school systems in Canada has been just plain numbers. There's been the shortage of teachers we all know about. At the same time, there's been the great flood of pupils, first into the elementary schools, then into the high schools, then sweeping on increasingly in the next two or three and 4 years into the universities. The school systems, on the whole, from what I can see across the country, have had to fight desperately just to provide some kind of buildings and some sort of teaching for all the pupils. They simply haven't been able to do very much about improving the quality of teaching as a whole. Also, we know, I've gathered it's true from conversation since I came here, that there's a great variation among different schools right in different provinces, especially with regard to the kind and quality of preparation for university work. In Ontario, I know that quite a number of people in the universities, with some of us in Carleton very much included, are decidedly concerned about the sort of intellectual condition of quite a fairly large proportion of students coming to the university. These are the kind of people who may have passed the not unrigorous senior matriculation examinations with fair marks. They've remembered enough from the right pages of the right books to build up the right totals on the scorer's cards in summer. But when they're entering what is the equivalent of second year at UBC, they just haven't learned enough to think and inquire for themselves and just haven't much of a glimmer of the university way of working. And of course, entering at that year, you've got to be going pretty fast and inquiry on your own and in absorbing a good deal of new knowledge and new concepts in most subjects. Actually, some discussions have been going on in the province, and there's now looks as some quite good possibilities of moving in the direction of tightening up the high school work up to the age of at the end of grade 12. Then we would hope and think of making a closer approach in grade 13 to the university kind of way of working, ending up with examinations perhaps on two levels, One more ordinary, one slightly more advanced. Which would be a better test, especially the more advanced ones. Not just of what had been learned, but of ability and readiness for the university kind of work. Certainly at the present time, the gap between high school and university work, which is so much talked about, is bigger than it should be. And we find, certainly at Carleton, I know at some other universities, that the gap is particularly great on the science side. People often comment about the lack of preparation on the art side, particularly in English. Now, our experience at Carleton is that, and the statistics show it, we have an English department that marks pretty hard, and the failures on the English side are not nearly as great as they are on the science and math side. The jump just seems to be a good deal greater on that side. The high schools, of course, we must realize that in the last generation have had an enormously difficult and complicated job. In the first place, there was the whole new concept that developed in the first part of the century, in the 1920s and 30s particularly, that high school education should be available to everyone. Then, on top of that, the enormous increase in the number of people of high school age just in the last few years. Sometimes I think university people themselves forget that the high schools have a dual job, perhaps a triple one. They have, of course, to deal with those who are potential university students. They're a minority. They have to deal, too, with the majority of pupils of not of that kind of ability. And, of course, many people think, and it's probably right, that majority in two, maybe perhaps, in turn, maybe perhaps divided into two kinds, people who should have a more vocational kind of training even at high school, and others, even though who may not be heading to university, but should, even at high school, be working still pretty consistently on the basic academic subjects, not right up to the university level, but going as far as they can so that they can go on to other training in industry or elsewhere and get the specialized work outside on the basis of pretty sound grounding in language and arithmetic. I don't myself think that we could have in Canada, or that we should try to have, a rigid segregation among high schools of different types along the English lines. I do feel that, in general, there's a great need of bringing along a good deal more quickly in the high schools those who are heading for university, and with a wide provision for change and shifting between the university stream and the other streams in both directions. But of course, when I know of the school systems, we can make progress in this direction to any great extent only if the high school systems in turn have greater resources provided to them in the form of money for better qualified teachers and the possibility of getting the highly qualified teachers at all, money for more classrooms and greater flexibility, more and better laboratories, more and better libraries. All those things cost money, but if we want to move just even a little bit more in the direction of the English sixth form, and we probably won't go very far, it'll cost quite a bit more money than high school work's costing now. When these same figures come out for this year, they probably show the total university enrollment in Canada for this year is about 111,000. I'm sure most people in this room are familiar with the projections of Dr. Sheffield and others, and according to these, this figure of 111 or 12,000 or so this year will double in the next 10 years. These projections, as you know, have been made by finding out, as could be done pretty accurately, the number of young people of 18 to 21 in the various years ahead. Then, in addition, adding to that, extrapolating the rise in recent years of the percentage of young people going to university. And out of the workings of these two factors, you get these remarkable increases. My own guess is, and my own guess has been reinforced a good deal by a conference I was at Abbotsford with a number of UBC people today. I heard some of Dean McPhee's latest tentative forecasts for the demand for university places in British Columbia. My guess is that in the years ahead, the number of qualified young people wanting to go to university may be a good deal higher than the present projections. I think this will happen particularly if other developments take place, if financial impediments are reduced, as I think they should be, if high school preparation for university is improved, as it should be, and then if I think if these things occur, the growing realization of the importance of higher education for those suited for it will lead to an even bigger demand than we now anticipate. I think, I haven't got a story now. I think in Canada, apart from universities, we have a very heavy need for additional institutions for continuing education, institutions other than universities. For instance, in many spheres, there is and there will be an increasingly large call for numbers of young people with sound technical training of various kinds. I'm not speaking of training for trades, training at that level, but the kind of fairly advanced technical or technological training, as it's often called, that can be given to people who have been through high school, or at least had several years of it and done pretty well in high school. And with two, or better, 3 years of good, sound instruction, people like that and now go on to interesting and well-paid careers, in many cases working with scientists, engineers, doctors, production people, business executives, and so on. I think there are quite a few people in universities now who would find good courses of this kind better suited for them, and they might go on to rather better lives afterwards if they tried this kind of course early. Some of you may be familiar with the Ryerson Institute of Technology in Toronto. I think it's a very good example of this. Certainly, I do know that in recent years, its graduates have done very well in a number of fields. Without them, the CBC probably couldn't have got television on the air. And these same graduates are very much sought after now. Throughout the country, we need a number of more institutions of this kind and working at about that level. They, of course, got to be good. If they are, their prestige will grow. They could take some of the pressure, I think, only some off universities in ahead, because I think also a number of people now who don't have any continuing education would go for them. And I think if they do develop, they could provide the foundation for very good, satisfying lives for a large number of, increasing number of young people. I think there's a case, too. For more junior or community type of colleges in Canada. It seems to me also that there's quite a need for clear thinking and for sorting out of priorities in this subject. For example, in Ontario, which I know much better than here, there's quite a lot of talk about junior colleges and agitation in some parts of the province. But in Ontario, grade 13 is a part of the system right through the province. And some of the junior college enthusiasts talk about the first 2 years of university work after grade 13. In other words, the equivalent of the second and third years of university work on most of this continent. I think these people don't seem to realize that when you get into the third year of university work in this scale, that you're getting into pretty senior work. That if it's to be done properly at all, it calls for decidedly senior university teachers, extensive library resources, well-equipped laboratories, and so on. I think it might be interesting in Ontario, perhaps in some other provinces, to try the experiment of dropping grade 13 in some areas, or perhaps some problems like this where grade 13 isn't very widespread, of trying it in an area, but of dropping grade 13 and then putting it into a junior college and adding 1 year above that. I think we might find out some very interesting things about getting well-qualified teachers for that level of work. But again, if junior colleges working in these years are going to do a good job with the students, and particularly prepare at least some of them well for senior years at university, they simply must have good staff, equivalent to at least some of the people at universities themselves, good library and scientific facilities. And the costs are a good deal bigger than some people realize. In areas such as Ontario, where the universities in general have been relieved of the whole task of teaching the whole first year level, or the grade 13 level, it seems to me that it's only natural priority should go first before you disrupt the whole thing, to greatly improving the quality of grade 13 instruction and bringing that whole year closer to the university way of working. I think it's plain from the discussions and arguments that go on that our present methods of deciding exactly who may and who may not go to university aren't satisfactory. Well, many parts of the country, there are criticisms of different kinds. There are criticisms of matriculation exams, usually on the grounds I mentioned, there are more tests of whether some material has been learned rather than of ability and than of general university capability. I think it's very important to consider these examinations because certainly in a number of areas, teachers criticize them because they say the very examinations themselves used as university entrance force them, the teachers, to drill in content to try to be sure of that their pupils will add up good marks and inhibiting them, the teachers, from trying to work more deeply with the students to range around various areas to explore new things to try to get the pupils thinking on their own to a greater extent. Same time with all these criticisms, most of the studies that I've read seem to indicate that matriculation exams, good firm external ones, seem to be still the best single predictors of university success, although they're very far from perfect. They seem by themselves to be better than other methods, as a rule, general ability and achievement tests, and better usually than just high school reports taken alone. I think we all know that raw matriculation marks alone are no guarantee of university successes. I think that certainly in most problems, I know the system's a bit different here, that selection could be improved a good deal by combining some of these methods, by combining marks on a improved, developed matriculation exams, developed more as a test for readiness for university work, with good high school reports and high school estimates of university capability, and with some additional tests of ability and achievement done particularly for borderline people. All this, of course, would take more time and effort and money, but I think it could result in a certain reduction in university failure rates and a better selection of those who go on. But I think, on the other hand, that in Canada we can't reasonably expect to reach a state in which everyone, or practically everyone, that is admitted to university goes on to succeed each year. I think quite a lot of nonsense is talked about this, the question of university failures. After all, there are some falters at every stage in education. For instance, in Ontario, according to some official figures I saw the other day, only half of those who start grade 13 end with a complete, successful senior matriculation. Compare early university results with that, they don't seem so bad. Then, of course, there's the fact that as well as inborn mental capacity, the will to work is just as important for university success. And that's something that you often can't measure by the very most skillful possible devices at the end of high school. And of course, it changes with different people from year to year. Some work much better and much harder under university conditions. Others slacken off under the greater freedom. I think we're all familiar with students who enter with good marks and then just fail miserably. There are those slightly strange people who manage to scramble in somehow, then after a year or two at the university, somehow catch a spark and go on to do very unusual things, often to become leaders in one walk of life or another. I think we've got to remember, too, that our whole system of higher education in Canada is different from that of either the United Kingdom or the United States. On the whole, the universities of Great Britain are now organized to turn out people who have concentrated deeply in specific fields of knowledge. As you know, there's a vast machinery of scholarships that bring about 80% of all students into university with public support. And it's said, and probably rightly, that it's pretty well true that no really able and hardworking, that means highly able and hardworking young person need miss university just because of lack of money. I think it's right to say that the whole aim in Great Britain at the present time is to draw a highly selected top fraction of young people into universities where they'll do intensive and pretty specialized work. And of course, at the present time, proportionally, only half as many young people go to university in Britain as they do in Canada. And according to the plans that are contemplated so far in Britain, and just an announcement of a new royal commission on the subject, but so far, according to the plans, the number of university places there will not rise relatively as much as in Britain, and the proportion of young people who will be able to go in the next 10 years will fall, not rise. The competition for those few places will get even more fierce than it is. And of course, in Britain at the present time, authorities will agree that a number of people who they say are qualified for university work, even under the high British standards, wanting a specialized work at the university in particular fields of knowledge, the number of people qualified present time are not able to go, just aren't among those chosen. Some people think Canada should follow this pretty example, or seem to, and reserve university opportunities for this very thin upper slice of the most able people who go on to specialized careers of one sort or another. I just don't think this policy would be practical in Canada, or that it would be desirable under Canadian conditions. It certainly has its critics in Britain. I know some keen observers who feel that England in the future is going to have plenty of really top specialists, but that it's going to suffer from a lack of sort of middle-range kind of people, people with interesting, strong character, and with the general kind of higher education fitting them, providing a foundation for work for many kinds of responsible positions. As I say, I believe that our kind of society in Canada, the objective should be not provide opportunity for just a brilliant 4 or 5% of young people, but for a broader band of those who have not just the brilliant minds, but still they must be good minds. In other words, for those who are able to work and ready to work at a true university level, not a weak one, a true university level, and to work very hard at it. Then comparisons are made with the United States. Some people, for instance, are critical because they say that failure rates at Canadian universities often run from 20 to 30% in the first year or two, while they're under 5% at Harvard and some other famous institutions. I think critics like that just ignore the differences, complete differences in conditions that apply. Harvard and these other places they mention are private institutions and they're places of great prestige. 10 and more times as many applicants as they can accommodate each year, and most of those applicants, already pretty good ones, ask for admission. Then the universities go through all sorts of complicated procedures and try to pick out the few that they think will make the very best students of all. As they do it, they turn away hundreds of people they know are perfectly good university material under ordinary circumstance. In the United States, of course, there are scores of other places where the unsuccessful applicants or any prestige institution can turn. And with high factors like that, it's perfectly natural that the failure rates are low, and they certainly should be. But we have to remember that the whole structure of a higher education in this country is different. Across the border, for instance, there's the sharp distinction between private and state institutions. Private institutions, those with the great prestige, can be very selective. Most of the state universities and colleges have pretty wide open admission policies. Many of them have to by law. Quite a number of these count on doing their real selection work inside the university. Of course, among the private institutions, there's some who can be highly selective, and there are others who probably select much more by the height of their fees than by other standards. And their standards of admission are very different from the prestige people prestige places that are so well known. In Canada, on the other hand, all our universities, whether or not they happen to be public or private, in legal terms, are supported by public funds in large part. I just don't believe that the Canadian public would continue to support universities if they restricted their doors to an elite of only the very brightest students. Again, there aren't any great differences of standards among Canadian universities. There's actually quite a good deal of homogeneity in the system. And then because of our great distances and fairly small population, and rather small number of universities strung all the way across the continent, and a very wide choice in higher education just isn't open in practical terms to a great many young Canadians. Of course, there are, of course, some differences of approach in academic policies. I think it's probably a good thing that these distinctions grow as the number of universities grows. In considering who should go to university, I think we have to look at Canadian higher education pretty much as a whole. I don't think that in the foreseeable future we can have or shall have the variety of institutions that there is in the United States, or all these varying forms and varying standards of higher education. And if the Canadian universities in general tried to follow the example of Harvard, the total enrollment in Canada would drop to a fraction of what it is, and the Canadian people simply wouldn't stand for it.
I think that,
as in so many other fields, in Canada, in fact, we shall continue to follow a middle way between the Great Britain and the United States. I think it's right for our particular needs that we should. I don't think it should be a wandering middle way. I think a one chosen deliberately and followed with pretty straight driving. I don't think we should try to be as restrictive as the English system is. I don't think we could be. On the other hand, I don't think we should or should try to be as broad as the United States system taking as a whole. Down there, the figures are rather imprecise, but apparently over 36% of all young people are going on to some form of higher education. I don't think that in Canada we can afford that much dilution, although we should think in those terms. I think we think in terms of solid, sure work of trying to get the right people who go, but not trying to shovel everybody who wants to go into university. I think we should try to see that those who have the real ability and the necessary drive for work at really solid university standards do go. Determining just who these are, I think, will continue to be a difficult process and a never perfect one. I think we can improve selection methods. I do think we have to accept the fact that unless we became very restrictive, that there will be a certain amount of selection go on in the universities themselves, and that's not necessarily a serious thing or if there's any great loss involved. I think the sense of failure which some people might gain from not succeeding at university, it can be quite unfortunate. I think it can be outweighed by the very experience those same people had at university. There is cost involved, of course, in their studying, unsuccessful studying, but against that there's the advantage of presumably the best selection of all, so a selection of by the university itself of people working under the university conditions themselves. I think it's pretty clear from all the studies that have been done and from the work of individual universities, certainly by work we've done at Carleton ourselves, that you just can't, there's no arbitrary line in terms of marks that you can draw and say that all those above it will be successful and those who below it will fail. It's quite easy, of course, to count on the really top students, the very top and succeeding, and it's easy to find them by whatever method you use. When you get down the scale, certainly in terms of senior matriculation marks, the uncertainties increase, and I think the uncertainties will always be there. For instance, a considerable number with averages above 60%, I think these Ontario terms will fail. Quite a number, we know in Ontario, with those allowed in with averages under 60% will go on to succeed very nicely. Actually, most of the studies show that the difference in failure rates among those entering with averages of 55 to 60, 60 to 65, and 65 to 70, the differences in their percentage of their success are not enormous. They vary 5 or 6 or 7 percentage points between those ranges. If we arbitrarily hoisted university requirements a good deal higher than they are now in terms of marks in the present examinations, university failure rates could be reduced somewhat. I don't think as much as many people think. But at the same time, this action would shut off the opportunity for quite a few others who now, at the present time, turn out to do very well in university and very well later on in life. I think this whole matter of selection needs a good deal more study than it's had now. I still think, in spite of all this, that the most important factor of all in higher education standards is the standards maintained by the universities themselves for the work that goes on within their walls, and they can't blame anybody outside for that. I've been talking about who should go to university. Another aspect of the same question is, who will be able to go? For whom will there be places? Actually, the breadth of opportunities for higher education will be determined really not by the universities, but by the society around them. What they're able to do will depend on the resources which society is willing to allot to its universities. Universities, of course, have several functions which complement each other. They are society's main centers for the discovery of new knowledge. At the same time, they are main places for the conservation of knowledge of the past and its organization. Through graduate work, they have to produce the people whom we need so badly, capable of working in various ways, working in the outer reaches of knowledge. They have to provide facilities for learning to the ablest young people, the kinds who can work in really high levels, the kind of work represented at the undergraduate level by honors courses. I believe that they should provide opportunities too, as we said, for general higher education, for young people who have a real desire for learning for its own sake, who want the disciplined intelligence that comes with sound work for a sound first degree. And I believe that not one but all these sectors of university work need reinforcement in Canada. There's a good deal more research with greater funds behind it going on now than there was, say, a dozen years ago. But I think that the outside world is moving faster than we are. Others are finding new knowledge at a faster rate. I don't think now we can say we're in the forefront of discovery as a nation, even taking our smaller size into account. At the same time, increased and improved graduate work is badly needed in Canada. For one thing, we just aren't going to have a chance of providing good teaching for these greater numbers of undergraduates unless we can find a larger number of good students and give them opportunities for and induce them to take increased opportunities for graduate study. Besides, as the mass of knowledge grows, the real qualifications for people who can be effective, really effective in many fields, those qualifications are rising all the time. I think that there should be more Canadian undergraduates doing honors work than there are. I know it varies from university to university. But according to my own observation, according to reports from at least some other universities, there are quite a few students who are really clever enough for honors work, but they aren't doing it. I think a great number of them don't seem to realize the advantage to their careers later, or the just general stronger intellectual formation they'd get from an honors course, or else perhaps they just can't be bothered to make the extra effort. Same time, of course, I think we should certainly not weaken, but actually further strengthen more general undergraduate courses. I think it's essential to maintain a really good balance among all these elements in the university purpose. I think we should try to advance on all parts of this front simultaneously. But the necessary kind of coordinated advance can take place only to the extent that society provides the necessary support. For instance, it should not be expected, I think, that universities could, with quite inadequate funds, carry on research work and advanced teaching of the quality required by modern conditions and still accept swelling numbers of undergraduates. If research work of the graduate and honors kind were restricted in favor of just teaching something to swelling masses of undergraduates, then I think the future would be lost. Canada would drop further behind in the search for knowledge and its application and couldn't even help to provide enough of its own university professors for the future. Some people in the United States have suggested that many more undergraduates could be taught by fewer professors, and of course at cheaper rates, through reductions in the number and kinds of courses available, together with large classes and some special individual assistance in senior years. I think we have to be quite wary about such proposals and examine them very carefully. I think universities in this country should guard against unnecessary proliferation of courses, and particularly against too much duplication of narrow specialties in different parts of the country. I think it should be remembered, though, that even though certain subjects are studied only by a few people, those same few people may be very important. In Canada, for instance, I believe that we need not less, but a good deal more study of the languages and civilizations of Asia and Africa and Eastern Europe. But the number of people studying in each of these particular sectors might be very small, and the teaching might be expensive. I think we need it badly. If something has to be sacrificed because of insufficient funds, I think what is sacrificed should be numbers and not quality. But I see no reason why there should be any such sacrifice in Canada. We must maintain a drive for excellence, even at the cost of some pretty good people having less opportunity. But we simply are not so poor a nation that we can't afford that necessary slice of our income needed to support a university structure that can do really good research work, train the scholars and specialists, and at the same time provide opportunities for solid higher education of a more general kind to those really capable of benefiting from it and ready to work for it. I'm not suggesting that the Canadian people should write blank checks to support happy havens for all the young men and women who can struggle through high school. I do think our universities in this country should as they do, cover a pretty wide spectrum of learning, from doctoral and postdoctoral work at the top down to solid work for bachelor's degrees of a general kind. I think this regular degree teaching should be kept strong and kept open to young people who have good minds and are ready to work for the privilege. But I think while this range of university teaching can be broad, it mustn't be stretched too far at the lower edge. Universities just can't deal with many dull and rather slack students and still provide proper opportunity for the bright and the really hard-working ones. If the span between the best and the worst becomes too great, then the opportunities for the good ones are bound to suffer, and they, after all, they're the most important of all, finally. I do think it would be tragic for Canada if we shut the doors of higher education to any significant number of young people able and ready to work at university standards just because of money. I think myself that the most important single thing that we can do for the future of Canada is to maintain and improve the research and teaching powers of our present universities and to add new ones of similar quality as they are needed. Doing all this will take just a tiny part of all we spend.
Perhaps I could start one off, Dr. Dent, by asking what you'd think of instituting in Canada a type of college board examination similar to the American system.
I think the college board thing, kind of thing, could be used as a very interesting supplement to other examinations here. To me, it would be too bad to throw over the general essay type of examination for school people until we have to in this country, partly because of the valuable experience it provides for what they're going to have to face at the university later.
Dean Myers?
Clear to us that the Canadian people want, and I think the quite right, a liberal policy of admission to the universities as a whole, even though it may not be applied to all universities. The second point is that local communities will certainly demand that the standards of their universities should be at least comparable, even if not necessarily as high as the highest in the world. And the third proposition is that everyone, particularly in the press and public utterances, deplores high failure rates. Now, it seems to me that those three propositions cannot coexist. One of them has to go. You cannot have low failure rates, liberal admission, and high standards together, unless the teachers of the university are superhuman, which they are not. And I'd like to ask Dr. Duncan which of those three, in his opinion, should go. Maybe they should all go to a certain extent.
I believe, first, that we could and should improve selection methods to some extent, just to do a better job with it, apart from whether it's, one argues whether it's higher or lower, to find out those people who are likely to succeed better than we are now. That'll still be imperfect, and I think those three factors, that we must realistically realize there will continue to be a fair number of failures under the best selection system we could devise, as long as it's, if you say, reasonably liberal, that is more liberal than the British system. There are quite a few failures in it too. I think, in other words, both. Some better selection, but also realization and acceptance of a certain number of failures. That, in other words, selection by the university itself inside the university.
Yes? Yes.
There's a very different picture about English universities that a lot of people can't get in. But they have an excellent adult education program, which we haven't got. And I sometimes wonder whether a lot of people at our universities wouldn't be better off doing a job of the day than improving their education in better adult education institutions, and not just the fancy sandwiches and
make
canoe.
I wonder if they got the question. Did you all hear that question? Well, Mrs. Burney asked Dr. Dunton, or stated that in England, the fact of the matter was that more people took the adult courses outside of the university, and that she wondered whether or not here at this university, in Canada, a lot of these people that are now clogging the university might better be taken and put into these adult courses or take them voluntarily themselves. Now, that's the question. Yes, and that the institutions of adult education in England are superior, and I presume could handle them there, and that they should be able to, you suggest, handle them in this way here.
I think somebody from UBC ought to answer the question about adult education facilities.
Have the director extension.
I thought perhaps I understand the opportunities right in this city are pretty extensive. I'm nothing against, I'm all for opportunities for people doing work after university, even of a degree kind, and I think that sort of education is going to grow greatly in this country. To me, it isn't a complete substitute for reasonable opportunities for young people at their developing stage, you know.
Mr. Harlow, you were next on this question.
I don't think it can be imposed because provinces and universities value their autonomy so much. But there are meetings among universities and representatives. I think there's one of the Western universities coming up in the next few days. And I think universities actually can, with a bit of goodwill, agree on avoiding duplication of that kind, and should do more than they are doing now.
Now, there's a gentleman over in the center section, yes?
I agree with Dr. Benjamin that our future definitely depends on brain. And it's possibly difficulty in selection and difficulty choosing the waste issue that's going on for people not getting the university. To my knowledge, there's only one place in Canada where a person can go on and get a degree in the evening. Certainly these people that have been unable to go on for financial reasons or selection for any other reason should certainly have a chance. And as far as I know, this is not true in BC and not true in any other province except Montreal.
Well, I thought the one you were mentioning was Carleton. Sir George Williams in Montreal does a lot of that. We have ourselves over 1,100 people doing credit courses, 4 degrees after 5 o'clock in the evening. Actually, there are quite a few in Toronto, too. Increasing number there. It's quite a problem for the University of Toronto with its interest in the higher reaches of knowledge. And I think this thing will grow, but the standards, certainly at Carleton, I think most places, the standards for admission to those courses are no lower than to the university itself. They must be properly matriculated if they're to be counted as credit and toward degree. In fact, if they're to take them in a regular series at all.
The gentleman over on this side, Mr. McDonald.
I'm getting a little worried about this phrase liberal attack to it. there was attached to it for several different reasons. I said several times in my speech, probably I thought I reiterated too much, that I think selection methods should be improved, the kind of matriculation examinations should be modified a good deal and improved to find so that they determine better who is capable of going on than they do now. In other words, I'm not satisfied with present selection procedures for the objectives we want, or the objectives I was trying to outline here. So I'm worried a little bit about liberal. But in improving methods, I would still not to be myself be in favor of searching for people, just the honors people, just those who will be specialists and scholars, but for people who can do sound general degree work, sound work for a general higher education. That probably doesn't answer your question. Are you suggesting the standard of university work as a whole is going down in the country?
I don't mean to suggest. I'm seeking information on the subject. I'm wondering if it has, in fact, deteriorated by reason of the open door policy that seems to prevail.
I think there's a bit of confusion on this subject. Quite often people talk about the dangers of more and more people flooding into universities and depressing the standards. They talk as though much less well-qualified students are going to university now than they were. I think by any ordinary comparison, certainly in Ontario and Quebec, the standards for admission to university are considerably higher now than they were 20 or 30 years ago. In those days, about 4% of young people went to Canadian universities, now 10. I'd suggest to you that even with the present imperfect methods, the 10 are more highly selected than the 4% were 20 or 30 years ago, so I don't think you can talk about what you say, increasing liberal admission standards, reducing university work. Do you agree with me, or? Oh, it's fun. Oh, now you're getting on another subject. My question was, who should go to university, not what size should universities be?
No, common recommendation of poison. I don't think they're familiar with the either Calvin or the Antrami, or it's never been described.
The chairman suggests I might just say a word about how the admission system works, say in Ontario. By law and in fact, all school systems, practically all, provide grade 13 work. The only formal general provincial examination is senior matriculation, which is a province-wide examination with everything marked in a central place in Toronto with enormously complicated procedure. Most of the universities admit people only with senior matriculation, with a standing usually of 60% in senior matriculation. Two or three of them, in which we are one, still maintain a sort of vestigial first year into which people can come with junior matriculation standard, although that is not general at all. But at the present time, formal marks in senior matriculation are the real gauge of university entrance. There are no recommendations of any kind. They're just the written the regular examinations.
Sir.
You mean question of lecture room techniques of faculty members, or the more general one of the teaching strength in terms of number and quality of staff and facilities?
I'm thinking of both the matter of techniques, the matter of size of classes, and so on.
I think all the universities I know are very much concerned about size of classes, about staff-student ratios, and feeling most of them, those ratios are under pressure because of the rising demands from numbers and slowly rising financial resources. I think we're all concerned about it in universities everywhere, probably more concerned than about the techniques used by faculty members. I think that's the essence of the whole thing, that if Canadians want good universities that can do good teaching and carry on their other research and scholarly work, then they've got to pay more than they're paying for them now. Canada isn't paying enough for its higher education and its search for knowledge. And doing on a more adequate basis would still not take a very noticeable part of our national income.
Sir.
Dr. Dundon, if the senior matriculation examination is that at the end of a five-year course in high school, or is that at the end of a four-year course?
End of a five-year course in high school.
And does that admit to the second year of the university?
It's very confusing, but it's what you would call second year, what McGill would call second year, but in Toronto McMaster and Queens and Western is called first year, but it's the equivalent of second year here.
So their requirements for their first year are really higher than in most other universities.
A year higher. Saskatchewan is the same. Alberta is the same from its senior matriculation. Manitoba's in between. Quebec is more junior, and the Maritimes is more junior matriculation.
Of course, it'd be impossible to say whether a much difference is noticed between the first-year people at Toronto and say, the first-year people at the University of British Columbia. There's no way of making a comparison there, I suppose, to see whether that extra year is warranted.
Well, Toronto, or I'd say it from Carleton, I'd say it myself. People at above senior matriculation are pretty much equivalent to people who've done first-year university work at some university. We've done quite a lot of studying on this, and we can't find any very significant difference. At a conference I was at this afternoon, I gather some people were saying that in this province, they found that quite often people who've come in with senior matriculation don't seem to do quite as well as people who've done first year at the university here. And someone suggested those senior matriculation people often weren't the very best. They'd taken senior matriculation for some special reason. I think in Ontario the reverse tends to happen. The regular way to do things is to take senior matriculation. Some people who go to say, Carleton University of Ottawa, where we do have a first year, are quite often people who are trying to avoid senior matriculation for some reason. There's an anti-selection factor working, and we tend to get not as strong ones, and therefore they tend to do not as well on a percentage basis. I think there's a great deal of confusion about this year business. For instance, comparing figures between the provinces, in Ontario as a whole year of university work and the year with much the greatest numbers, which just isn't there, the first year at UBC or at McGill. Just doesn't exist. It's done in schools.
Would you like to answer? Do you want to tell us? One more?
Sure.
Okay.
No.
Take one more question. Well, perhaps we've troubled Dr. Denton sufficiently. He's had a full day. I think he got up really bright and early, and the person that was responsible, the acting president who's here this night, is responsible for this early hour. I think we'll ask him to thank our speaker. Dean Andrew?
Just still working.
Yes, still at it.
Still working. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to come here this time to express the thanks of this audience to Dr. Denton for this address of his tonight. I myself, in listening to it, couldn't help but be reminded of that much-read lecture of the last couple of years of C.P. Snow on the two cultures. And the thing in that much-read lecture that Dr. Denton's address tonight reminded me of was Snow's distinction between what he called the tactical and the strategic purposes of education, and particularly higher education. And he drew a sharp distinction for his own purposes there, between the tactical purposes of British higher education relative to what he called the strategical purposes of Russian and North American education. And reduced to its simplicities, his argument is this, that the North American idea of attracting into the process of higher education very much larger numbers of persons of adequate capacities, adequate to much better capacities, was, he felt, in terms of national and human well-being, much more important than concentrating on the technically or tactically more efficient higher education of the smaller stream. That this was, from his point of view, a much wiser, strategic, basic idea. And as I was listening to Dr. Denton tonight, I kept on rejecting words like liberal and latitudinarian and loose. And as he went on talking, I found myself coming to the conclusion that we were hearing an excellent and expert exposition of the strategic importance to national and human well-being of a highly selective system of higher education that was designed to catch as many people as well qualified as possible in the net to develop, if I can put it this way, plateaus of culture and peaks of scholarship. And for this very expert and detailed exposition, I, on your behalf, would like to thank Dr. Denton very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I should only like to remind you that within the general series and intra this series, this is the second of a series of three lectures on the general topic of higher education. The last speaker will be Dr. Murray G. Ross, the president of the new university in Toronto called York University, and he will speak on January the 14th on our universities getting too big. On that occasion, you will have your opportunity to ask questions and rebuttal for those who have not had a chance this evening. For the last lecture of this season, which is next Saturday, December the 10th, I am reminded that I did not give you the proper title of Dr. Gibson's subject. His subject on this occasion will be Doctors and Social Progress. This lecture will be held at our usual place. We have again, I think, obtained rooms 104 and 106 at the Buchanan Building, and we invite you to this last lecture. Good evening.